The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
First of all, I want to wish a very happy new year to all of my loyal listeners who have kept We Are Not Alone on WHFR for the past 40 years. No, I wish. I do want to wish you a very happy new year, and I hope you had a great holiday season. So moving right along, though, our guest today is Mindy Tuffes. Mindy was the Oklahoma State Director of MUFON and the author of the recently published book, Dying to Meet Them, One Woman's Incredible Journey from NDE to UAP. She is published on both books and articles on unidentified aerial phenomena and near-death experiences. She has had her own near-death experience, so she is able to understand the phenomenon from that vantage point and has written about it extensively. The overlap found between these two distinct phenomena represents a personal quest in understanding their origin, significance, and ultimately their implications. Mindy has appeared on talk shows, podcasts, and television programs, speaking as a trusted expert on both subjects. As a state director of the Mutual UFO Network for several years, she has investigated numerous unexplained UAP cases, including cattle mutilations, schoolyard encounters and abductions, and I'm pleased that she has agreed to take the time to be a guest on our show. So welcome, Mindy, and a happy new year to you.
Well, thank you, Dave, and happy new year to you too.
Thank you. So tell us about your new book, Dying to Meet Them.
Well, this was kind of the beginning of my quest into ufology in the modern era. I always had a very deep interest as a child, and I would, instead of watching cartoons, I would go in and watch sightings and unexplained mysteries and, you know, anything that I could find. I would even ride my bike down to the bookmobile and go check out anything I could find on the unexplained and especially on UFOs. And so in 2016 is whenever I had the life-changing event that led to my near-death experience. At the time, I was an ICU nurse, and I was married to a Southern Baptist minister, and we were living out on a 300-acre wheat farm up in northern Oklahoma. And I was home by myself that day. My husband was at school with the kids. He taught and did some coaching, you know, just to pay the bills. And I heard this loud explosion go off in my head. And at first I thought maybe I had been shot because I had seen coyote hunters out around the area. And whenever I kind of focused on the back of my head, I realized that's not what happened. And I thought, okay, this has got to be some kind of brain aneurysm or something, because just the severity of it. Once that gunshot went off, it almost felt like an electrical avalanche that went from the top of my head down to my feet. And I immediately started losing consciousness. And that's not to say that I lost awareness during that. Mm-hmm. I was fully cognizant of all of my thoughts the entire time. I was sitting on the couch and facing towards the door, waiting for my husband and kids to come home because it was election day. It was November 8th. And so there was the big presidential election between Trump and Hillary. And of course, we wanted to go do our civil duty and go vote. Mm-hmm. And so I had the front door open. I was waiting for them to come home anytime. And my heart just broke because I knew the severity of what had just happened to me and that I more than likely could not survive it. And my thoughts just turned to my kids and my husband, and I started praying, you know, God, don't let my kids come in and find my body. And I thought, well, my husband, he's not going to handle it very well either. And it broke my heart. I prayed to God, you know, if I can survive this, please let me. And I was so heartbroken and so deep in prayer that I kind of lost track. And the next thing I know, I opened my eyes and I'm in pure darkness. And I thought, okay, well, what is this? You know, I'm not hurting. I'm just kind of in this darkness. And my first instinct was to put my hand out in front of my face so that I could see if I could see it. You know, I was trying to determine if it was dark or if there was just nothing there. And I put my hand out and I couldn't see it. So the next thing I did was try to clap my hands. And you'll see on the front of the book, there's actually a hand in the darkness. And that's exactly what I was looking for. But when I tried to clap my hands, I wasn't able to do so. And that's when it really hit me. Oh my gosh, I'm really dead. And
no physical body to clap your hands.
There wasn't. And I couldn't see any physical body. Although I maintained my humanity, I maintained all my thoughts and all of my personality and all my memories. I mean, my thoughts the entire time I was over there was on my husband and kids, and about my own salvation. I started praying and I was looking expectantly for the ray of light or, you know, my grandma and grandpa to show up or for Jesus to appear. And the more time I waited, the more I started kind of getting more nervous because nothing was happening. And I'm trying to prepare myself. I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to go to judgment. Is this going to be, you know, am I going to heaven or hell? And so I turn to my Christian thinking and I'm saying, Jesus, be my righteousness. Jesus, I can't get in without you. Where are you? You know, please, please don't forsake me and come, you know, stand with me. And nothing happened. And so I start turning my thoughts back to my husband and kids. You know, I'm praying for them if they found my body by now, that God would comfort them. And the whole time I'm just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, the anxiety starts building because nothing is happening. This is not according to my Christian teaching. And so I start looking inward. And I didn't have like a life review like many near-death experiencers do. I instead just kind of evaluated myself and my life, and just thought of just different instances within my life. It wasn't like I was shown it. It was just me more evaluating myself. Mm-hmm. And I started realizing, okay, I need to learn to love myself. And as soon as that thought came to mind, a male entity came up behind me over my left side, and I couldn't see him. I could only sense him there, and I could tell that he was male, but he wasn't like divine. It didn't feel like God was there. It didn't feel like it was Jesus. It didn't feel like this was a guardian angel or anything like that. But I could not identify him as human either. And as soon as I started realizing I had to learn to love myself, he said, "You're not going to be here forever." And I instantly was like, "Okay, great. You know, I'm not here by myself. There's someone else here, and I'm not going to be here forever." And whenever he did this, we started sailing off to the left. And out in front of me, I could see this purple glow.
So
and as
you were out of this void by now, right? This black.
I'm still in the void at this point. And I don't want to give the impression that the void was terrible for me. I called it the dark abyss. It was terrible in that I was frightened and I didn't understand where I was or what was happening, but I felt God all around me, the immense force all around me, that just encompassed everything. And what was so bad for me was that I was separate from it. It was almost like I was in my own little box, separate from God and all of creation, everything throughout all time. So God was definitely there with me. But what my expectation was not being met and what I was figuring would happen. So anyways, when this male entity came to me, we soared off to the left and we started seeing this purple glow in the distance. And as we got closer, it looked like a nebula and it almost had an appearance of like a map of brain neurons. It was bright pink, had these bright pink lines, and where they joined up, it glowed really brightly yellow. And it just gave off immense love, so much love. And he told me, the entity that was with me, he said, "That's the fabric of humanity." And I wanted to go to it so bad, but he said, "No, it's not for you." And so we sailed off more to the left, and then I was back in my body. And I explain in the book, it was almost like a computer rebooting. It was whenever I went back in, it was like it's hard to even put into words. It was like I rebooted back up and I could hear the buzzing in my ears. I felt the instant pain and I knew something terrible had happened. I had had a stroke. My right arm was hanging limp. And I was able to find my phone and call my father-in-law who lived right across the street. And I just slurred out something to him and he knew immediately something is terribly wrong. And he was standing in my living room within 30 seconds to a minute and was getting me to help. Shortly after, my husband and kids arrived and they took me to the hospital. And you've read the book, turned into 2 years of suffering because they dismissed me and told me that I had had a migraine or that my neck had shifted or something, something ridiculous. And
here
despite
your right arm was still hanging when you went to the doctor and, or the hospital and they said, "Oh, you had a migraine." Is that right?
I know. Yeah. And I went back multiple times. I went back to the ER that next day because I had had another stroke and they sent me home once again and said, "This is a migraine that looks like a stroke. Go home, take a bath, relax. It's not going to hurt you." So,
I shouldn't laugh, but oh my God, you know?
Yeah. Here I am an ICU nurse. You know, I think that I was able to mask my pain. I wasn't screaming and hollering, even though I was in tremendous amounts of agony. And like it says in the book, it went on for 2 years before we finally sold our home and moved back to Oklahoma City. And the doctors got me in within 2 weeks. And they had found out that I had had what's called a vertebral artery dissection. So one of my main arteries actually ripped in two different places there within my neck going up into my brain. And by the grace of God, it healed itself without any kind of medical intervention. I didn't have as much as a Tylenol to deal with that. But, you know, I've regained everything that I lost during that time, except for my hearing. I now wear hearing aids because I lost 90% of my hearing. Wow. But small price to pay for what I've been able to do now. So this is how I got into ufology.
Here comes the connection. First of all, let's talk about, you say the fabric of humanity. Can you define what is meant by the fabric of humanity?
You know, I can't. I wish I could. To me, it seemed like the spirit of everything good from all of humanity throughout all of time resides there.
Would that extend to other sentient beings throughout the universe?
I don't know. It was the fabric of humanity. So I imagine it would be just from humans. That's a very good question. I had a small glimpse of it. I felt the immensity of it. Mm-hmm. It felt like it was, you know, infinitely important within the scheme of things. And I've even questioned if I reside there sometime in the future, and that's why I was not able to go there then. Mm-hmm. It's hard to put into words whenever you're dealing with all of time and all dimensions. You know, it gets very deep, and it gets a lot deeper than I am smart. So, mm-hmm. But my impression of it was everything good about us, all of our good deeds, every time that we extend our hand to a fellow human, that's recorded there. Yeah. And what a wonderful place to be.
Well, don't you feel that we will get into the connection between, the ETs and NDEs, but don't you feel that all beings throughout the universe, ET, whatever they are, other dimensions, have souls as well?
Well, now you're getting into theology. I've heard several different things. As far as the grays, they're more of a manufactured biologics.
Yeah, I thought they might be clones.
Right. And so do they have souls? I don't know. I'd like to meet one. We can ask them.
Really? I think we have. We just don't remember.
Yeah. But,
okay. So I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. So to bring in the ufology link, whenever it would have been about 3 years, we were living here in Oklahoma City, and I ended up having another episode that landed me back in the hospital. And we don't know if it, ripped again or what, but I was hovering, blood pressure was 40s over 20s. I was not doing well. I was in the neuro step down unit here at the local hospital. And I talked to my husband and I said, look, I will not survive another one of these. And we really need to have some deep conversations, because I don't want to just pretend like I'm doing just fine and leave you without any plans going forward if I leave.
Yeah.
And so we did. We started discussing, mom has burial plots over here at this cemetery that she'll, let me be buried in. And I want these people to be involved in the kids' lives. Because whenever I had the first dissection, the kids were 5 and 7. Mm-hmm. And so they were still quite young whenever I went back in the hospital. So out of that conversation, my husband is ever an optimist. And he said, well, let's do something good. What do you want to do while you're here? And I said, I want to go to Roswell. So this dear man booked us a trip to Roswell during the festival in 2019. And loaded up the kids. We went out there and had a great week meeting all of these wonderful researchers. And it was just a dream come true for me. I never knew that you could just walk up and talk to people that are huge in the field. And one of the people I talked to while there was Kathleen Martin, who is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill with the huge abduction case from the 60s up in the Northeast. And at the time, she had just started the experiencer resource team for MUFON. And I said, well, how did you do it? How did you get involved? You know, how do you even break into ufology? It was something I had always wanted to do. And she said, well, check out MUFON. So that's what we did on the way home. I'm pulling up on my cell phone and reading to my husband everything about MUFON. And I had heard of MUFON before, but I thought that I didn't have anything to offer. I had looked at it when the kids were real young. And I thought, well, I'm not military. I'm not a police officer. You know, I don't know if I have anything to offer. And I talked myself out of it. Well, this time I didn't. We ended up reaching out to headquarters, and I got a hold of Doug Wilson, who was our director of investigations at the time. Mm-hmm. And he spoke to me for 2.5 hours on the phone, and I could not believe, I'm like, this is like the number two guy in the organization, John, and he's talking to me. Mm-hmm. I could not believe it. And I asked him, you know, are there meetings here in Oklahoma that we could go to? And he said, well, the state director's had some health problems and has had to step down. So we really need to start kind of rebuilding that chapter there if you're interested in being a field investigator. And I said, I can do that. And he said, absolutely, let's get you started. And I mean, I went home and I signed right up and got my manual. And I have all kinds of pictures on my phone with my manual. I was so excited to take the dive. And I did. Within a year, I was placed as state director. And then here recently, I was bumped up to director of training and have revised all of MUFON University and really standardized training for field investigators all throughout MUFON. I believe we have, what, about 500 now that will all be going through MUFON University.
Right.
So, so that's how it led into the UFO connection.
Okay. I need to take a moment right now to just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. And we're speaking with the author and, she was the Oklahoma State Director Mindy Tautvest. She's the author of Dying to Meet Them. Dying to Meet Them. So it took you not very long to go from, can I do these cases to, yeah, you can run the organization here.
Careful there. I'm not vying for Dave's job at all. I am so happy with what I've been able to accomplish here. In the last 4 or 5 years with MUFON, they have really just let me run the gamut. I come to Steve and to Bob Spearing, who are our Director of Investigations now and Director of Investigations International, and I bring them all these crazy ideas. Let's try doing this. Let's do that. Have we thought about doing this? And they say, sure, go with it. You know, if you plan it out, we'll implement it. And so I have worked with just a wonderful team within MUFON to be able to bring it up to current standards in so many areas. And it is such a dream come true for me. And that's really what drives me. Mm-hmm. So whenever I started looking into UFO encounters and started working with experiencers through the experiencer resource team, I finally got to join it. And talking with experiencers, I started going, man, these people sound like me. These people have changed in similar ways to what I did after my near-death experience. Mm-hmm. And I thought, am I just seeing things that I want to see? Or is there something here? And the more I looked into it, the more I tried to put it out of my mind, and I decided I would get a copy of Whitley Strieber's Communion. And I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on the UFO side of things now. And I start reading through it, and I get about halfway through, and he describes one night whenever he was wrestling with his encounters, and he had come home, and he had all these thoughts swirling in his mind. And he comes home and he sits down and he has this beautiful narrative about how he said that it was something ancient that had always known him, and it swirled around him and encompassed him and had known him throughout all of his time. And reading that, I thought, this sounds exactly like my words, exactly how I would describe my near-death experience and my encounter with the entity that I met over there. How can this be?
When you say through all of his time, from his birth or from, you know, the beginning of time.
That's how he described it. Have to ask Whitley, you know.
Yeah, okay.
But his words rang so true for me that I said, okay, someone else has got to have seen this before. Mm-hmm. If this is a true phenomenon, someone has seen the connection between near-death experiences and UFO experiencers. Mm-hmm. And that's when I discovered Dr. Kenneth Ring and the Omega Project. And Dr. Ring was a professor out at the University of Connecticut, and he had done studies on near-death experiencers, and he was incredibly given a copy of Whitley Strieber's Communion by a colleague who said, this guy sounds like your near-death experiencers. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, I don't do UFO stuff. Mm-hmm. And he humored his friend and went ahead and read through it. And he said, you're right. Let's look into this. So he developed a battery to compare UFO experiencers and near-death experiencers and see how they lined up. And by the end of this study, he had identified two main points. And the first point was that there was an encounter-prone personality that he related to either childhood trauma or inbound kind of ability or something that was fostered by, you know, a parent or something within childhood to teach children how to dissociate to the point of excluding their environment. So all of the near-death experiencers and UFO experiencers shared this commonality where they were able to dissociate and exclude everything around them. Hmm. They were really sending their mind into other realms. And he differentiated this from people who were fantasy prone. And he found that fantasy proneness was not high within the experiencers. So these aren't people that were battling dragons and stuff as kids. These were people that were actually making contact with entities in other places. Okay, and the second part was that he identified a set of after effects that were common between both sets of experiencers as well. And we saw that people were more spiritual. They weren't necessarily religious, but they were more spiritual and open to that kind of phenomena. Mm-hmm. They tended to be more altruistic and really believing in a greater love and a greater purpose. They saw the big picture. And along with these kind of changes, they also had physiological type of changes where they were affecting electrical appliances and lights and which you're familiar with. I mean, after my near-death experience, I would pass under streetlights and they would go out. And Zoom, oh my goodness, during the pandemic, I had the hardest time with Zoom. We would have everybody shut off every you know, tablet, phone, TV, anything using any kind of Wi-Fi in our home, so that I could use Zoom to do Zoom calls for MUFON, and it would still break out. And I constantly had trouble with it. But it tended to be when I was highly emotional. So whenever I tried to attend sharing groups with IANS, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies, I would have problems with my connectivity. And I also saw this at the MUFON Symposium. I had Case of the Year in 2021, and Bob Spearing was trying to do some last-minute touch-ups to the presentation for the Cases of the Year presentation that year. And I walked up to him, and all of the media disappeared. And I'm sitting there trying. I'm like, well, did you try doing this? Did you have a backup? Can you do, you know? And he was like, wait a minute, you're an experiencer. Walk away. And I was like, are you kidding? He goes, walk away. And so I did, hurt my feelings some, but I walked away. And I came back about 30 minutes later and said, did you ever recover that? And he said, as soon as you walked away, everything came back.
Wow.
So, and so that's some of the things that we see between both sets of experiencers, and the commonalities continue. Mm-hmm. One of the really cool things to come out of the book, out of my book, was reaching out to Dr. Ring, you know, just to get his blessing to be able to incorporate so much of his research into some of the later chapters. And he has become a wonderful friend. We've become pen pals and write back and forth quite often. And I'm so blessed to know the man, and for all of his contributions to both sets of phenomena. I think people weren't ready for it back whenever he wrote the Omega Project.
Right.
And it's all coming back around now, and people are starting to see that there's something to this.
Now, you say an experiencer. Have you had ET experiences? You had near-death experiences, but have you had an abduction / ET experience, contact?
I have not. I have seen unexplained lights in the sky, and this did not happen until after the near-death experience. I continue to have paranormal-type experiences with shadow figures, light orbs flying through the house, and this is stuff that's been witnessed by my husband and my kids, and that's very common. We know about the hitchhiker effect with ET experiencers. I believe that it's also very common within near-death experiencers, where there's something that is opened up to us, and we're able to have contact with some of these different types of phenomena.
When you say hitchhiker, that means this, something else has come aboard?
Yeah. Well, you hear it with like Skinwalker Ranch. They talk about the hitchhiker effect. Where things will follow them off of the ranch.
Right.
And people ghost, have run-ins.
Ghost hunters, they seem sometimes
yeah.
investigate a home, and they will experience a phenomenon. When they get home, they'll start experiencing phenomenon that wasn't there before. It kind of attaches itself.
Right. And that kind of gets into the other side of things. That's more of what the experiencer resource team looks at within MUFON. MUFON proper does not investigate anything like that. And I want to make that very clear. They're very nuts and bolts, UFOs only. But within my own research, I've seen that there is some kind of connection there. But there's many within MUFON that wouldn't agree with that statement either. Mm-hmm. So MUFON is made up of several different types of people, and that's what makes it so wonderful. But MUFON's official position is that there is no paranormal and that we investigate only UFOs.
Well, you know, the way I look at that, tell me if you disagree, paranormal, the whole spectrum of paranormal, there is no paranormal in that it's just outside of our understanding of normal.
Yes.
Outside of our understanding of natural law. So there's no unnatural things that can't have that. It's just outside
Right.
of our understanding of it. And
Yes.
in the past
But
100 years, we've learned that's true. Things that we didn't think 100 years ago were possible, now we know.
Yeah, some of these things seem magical back in the day.
Sure.
And now that we understand a little bit more, and, you know, maybe we'll get there. But I don't want to misrepresent to the audience. There's Mindy Totfest and my set of views and my research. And then there is also the MUFON side of things. And MUFON does not cross into some of the things that I research.
Right.
So I just wanted to make that very clear that there is, you know, a separation there. Even though I'm one person and I do both, there is somewhat of a separation between the two.
When I started this show, it was strictly UFOs. Anything UFOs or alien abduction, that was it, okay? And then I didn't really think about Bigfoot because that's cryptozoology and we didn't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started realizing that people have seen Bigfoot in the presence of UFOs. What's the connection? Maybe there is a connection. And then, like you say, near-death experiences as well, there's a connection there as well. So do you think that it's possible that ET craft and their occupants are from a dimension parallel to ours? So once a person crosses over to the other side for a brief time, you know, as an NDE, they establish a sort of bridge connecting them with the ET's dimension.
Yeah, and that's what I get into more in Chapter 9.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of what I came back with, was the very solid impression that almost like I was in a simulation, that was the true ultimate reality. I believe that some of what we're seeing could be originating from that realm. And one of the things that solidified that thought for me was whenever I came across the Gateway Process, which was put out by the U.S. Army. And this was back in the 80s. They were looking into how to create psychic spies and psychic soldiers.
All right.
And they were utilizing Hemisync through the Monroe Institute. And they were having their soldiers go through this Hemisync training to coordinate the two hemispheres of their brain and be able to send their mind into other realms. Well, the highest realm that they identified was the absolute. And the way that they described the absolute is that it is outside of any kind of construct or time or anything like that. It lined up exactly with what I experienced as the void. I am absolutely convinced that the absolute and the void are one and the same.
Mm.
And so they were trying to send soldiers psychically over there to connect with entities to bring back information that could help, you know, within the military.
Mm-hmm.
That lines up very much with what I experienced in meeting the entity there and him showing me the fabric of humanity. I'm sure if I would have asked him more, maybe he would have told me more. But I know that that's what our Army was trying to do back in the 80s.
Mm.
And so absolutely, I believe that some of these entities that were coming into contact are interdimensional and they are originating from the absolute or from the void.
Mm-hmm. So you regard ETs to be other dimensional as opposed to extraterrestrial, is that it?
Well, not necessarily. I believe it accounts for some of it. I also believe there's very good argument for there being some within inner Earth, under our waterways. And mm-hmm. You know, from other planets. I think that we're seeing a combination of different things being reported. And until we can get a better grasp on you know, who's coming from where, you know, we really need to start sorting these things. And that's one of the things within MUFON is trying to, you know, find commonalities between different sightings. And maybe eventually we'll be able to identify where some of these entities are coming from and which ones are presenting from where.
Right, right. Well, I think it's very possible that it's a combination, like you say, it's a combination of extraterrestrial, other dimensional, extraterrestrial coming through other dimensions. You know,
yeah.
That is the ticket right there, is they're coming through other dimensions into ours.
Right.
I had my sighting years ago, and I witnessed, my whole family witnessed, a craft coming through a hole in the sky.
Wow.
Yeah. And a perfectly clear sky, and smoke started billowing out of it. And this huge craft, size of a city block, hovered over our house. Found out later that my sister and I were abducted at that time. So,
wow.
My sister's been an abductee since childhood, but they didn't want me after that. They said, you go do a radio show. I'm I want your sister. So that's the way that was. So I'm sorry. I'm interrupting you. Go ahead.
No, I appreciate you sharing that. I didn't know that about you. That's incredible. So have you ever had any regression?
No, my sister did. And that's how she knew that we were abducted. All we really remember consciously is this craft over our heads. And my parents and my sister and I were up there. What is it? I don't know. And then this little tornado of smoke started coming down over here. And the next thing you know, it's gone, and we walk into the house and just went back to bed. And
wow.
So, and we found out, I found out later that that's very common, that after a sighting or after a abduction, you just go about your business like nothing happened. And then later you say, wait a minute, what was that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. We hear that time and again.
Yeah. Well, that's what happened with us. So anyway, back to you.
Okay.
So, Mindy, I have to take a moment once again to remind our listeners, you're listening to WHFR.FM, station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. This is We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with author of Mindy Totfest. Am I pronouncing that right? Totfest?
Yeah. Yeah, Mindy Totfest.
Okay. Author of Dying to Meet Them. I did want to ask you, Mindy, about this case from the 70s. In a recent podcast, you talked about the Hartshorne Public School UFO in the mid-70s. Would you review that case for our listeners?
Yes, this is. Was actually just speaking about the case of the year in 2021. That was this case. It was MUFON case number 116768, and it took place around 1975 out in Hartshorne, Oklahoma, which is down in the southeastern region of our state. And this came in, a young man had reported the sighting that they had out at the schoolyard back whenever he was about 10 years old. And it had stayed with him all of these years. Him and his brother would sometimes speak about it in private, but they never spoke about it publicly until they came to MUFON. And when it came in, this was right around the same time that the Aerial School documentary was coming out. There was a lot of talk about some of these different schoolyard encounters. So when it came in, I thought, oh my gosh, here's another schoolyard encounter that no one's even heard of. So I was very anxious to interview the witness and see what all he remembered with it being that long ago. And he was able to actually get together about 5-6 different witnesses that all recounted the same thing. The way that they describe it was they were outside in the afternoon and they were playing. The man that reported it, him and his brother were playing in the sandbox. And they were at a boarding school, and it was like a small Christian boarding school. Most of the people that lived there, most of the children were from the Buchanan family, whose mother and father were the ones that started the school. And then they had a few different sibling pairs that had come to live there as well. Mm-hmm. So in total, there were about 17 witnesses that were there during the event. And whenever they first saw it, it was just kind of a small object floating off in the distance. And one of the brothers pointed it out to the other and said, "Look, you know, what is that?" And he's like, "I don't know, you know," and they kept playing. And over the course of an hour or so, this thing slowly, slowly, slowly drifted towards them. And as it continued to get close, they started getting kind of nervous, and all the other kids on the playground were starting to take note of it. And they ran in to get Mother Buchanan and the school teacher, who was 18 at the time. And those were the two adults that were there. And they came out to watch it as well. Well, by the time they came out, they said this thing was hovering over a group of trees right there on their property, 20, 30 yards in front of them, and directly over them. And they said it was completely silent. And it was a saucer shape and had multicolored lights flashing sequentially around a middle band on it. And they said that it hovered. And one of the girls started screaming, and she was pretty scared. The oldest boy that was there, he was one of the Buchanan sons. He was a teenager at the time. He ran in and grabbed his rifle and actually climbed up on top of the schoolhouse to get a better view and to, you know, somewhat protect the women and children that were there. He was the man of the house at that time, since the Buchanan father was away. And so whenever he pointed his gun at the UFO, they said that it flipped up on its side and shot over about a mile away. And the oldest boy said that he saw it kind of settle next to the sawmill, which was still on the Buchanan property. They had over 6,000 acres out there, which is, eastern Oklahoma is very rugged, very hilly, and very densely forested in some areas. And so he actually saw it land in a clearing over there by the sawmill. And at that, they started running back inside. The teacher describes the kids being scared. Several of them ran in and were hiding under their beds. And she said that the oldest boy kind of stood guard with his rifle throughout the night. And some of the kids were saying that they were looking out the window and they were seeing entities out there. And when the teacher asked, "Well, what do they look like?" the kids said they just keep changing. They couldn't even describe it. So it was like shape-shifting. So they were pretty terrified. The oldest boy started boarding up the windows and doors to protect them. And sometime during the night, the teacher said that the sounds of nature returned, and she could hear the locusts and she could hear the cattle in the field next to them, and she knew that it was over. So they get through the night. That next morning, it's all the hubbub, you know. They get up, they pack up sack lunches, and the teacher actually takes them on a field trip to walk up towards the sawmill to see if it was still there. And when they got up there, it was gone, but they were looking for any signs of it, and they weren't able to find anything. So they head back, and all the kids remember taking this field trip and, you know, with their sack lunches and going up there to look for the UFO. When they come back, the teacher goes in to check the outdoor meat locker to see if they can, to get stuff ready for supper. And whenever she opens it, she sees that all of the meat has been gone. There was two sides of beef, processed beef, that was completely emptied out of the locker. And this was a bizarre thing because they actually had cattle there at the school, and none of the cattle were touched, but all of the processed beef was taken. And she said, astonishingly, the next day, she goes out there to show Mr. Buchanan, and all of the meat has been returned. Really? And he was like, he said, no, we're not eating this. And so he drug it out into the middle of the field and burned it. And they all recall eating oatmeal for the next several days because they burned all the meat. And so that was the Miracle Mountain Schoolyard encounter in a nutshell. And after closing out that case, it was incredible just speaking to all of these witnesses who recalled such similar events after all of these years. And many of them had not spoken to each other in 30, 40 years. Mm-hmm. And they still recalled the same events. And that was really one of the main things that supported what they had said. Mm-hmm. In investigating it, I went ahead and closed out the case, but I, you know, was curious. I had never heard of Hartshorn. And I've lived in Oklahoma my entire life. So I thought, okay, well, let's see what else has happened in Hartshorn. And I start digging and I come across a gentleman named Hayden C. Hughes. And he ran the International UFO Bureau, which he started here in Oklahoma City back in 1957. And he had been investigating Hartshorn sightings all through that area back in the 1960s. And he actually had teamed up with a woman named Alta Claire Morgan, who was the wife of the postmaster there in that town. And they had recorded over 110 sightings within an 8-month period, around 1965 into later in 65. And these sightings went on through the mid 70s. Many of the residents report seeing red blinking lights. They had two main types of UFOs that they saw up there. One was called the red blinkers because it looked like an ambulance beacon. Mm-hmm. And then there was one that they called the leader, which was a saucer shaped, which fits very much with what the kids saw there at the Miracle Mountains in 1975. And in speaking with people there now, they're still seeing things, especially in one region there around Hartshorn, that people have still seen unexplained things coming from that one area. Mm-hmm. So the sightings continue today.
That schoolyard sighting with these kids is kind of reminiscent of the Zimbabwe sightings.
Yes.
The kids. Didn't yes. the teacher see that as well in Zimbabwe?
I'm not sure. Yes, the teachers did. Yeah.
Yeah. So you could say, oh, well, it's just a bunch of kids. They saw something they didn't understand. They see a lot of things they don't understand, yada, yada, yada. But we're talking about teachers here now, grown-ups.
Yeah.
You know? And same way with the Hartshorn school. The adults saw it, too.
Yes, the adults saw it too, but I think the fact that these kids have such strong memories of what they saw. I mean, yeah. They knew that they saw something unexplained and it has stayed with them for decades and they can still recall the same thing. Mm-hmm. Even though they're living in different states and have lost touch with each other, they're still saying the same thing after all of these years. They saw something.
It's life-changing. This happened when my sighting happened when I was like 14 years old, and it's still fresh in my memory. I mean,
yeah,
you don't forget those things. You just don't forget them.
Extraordinary experiences.
And now, what did you think about the UAP congressional hearings?
Oh, my goodness. Which one?
Well, the Pentagon comes out and admits they're real, and they have congressional hearings on it. And they're finally starting to pay attention. What do you think about that?
I think that it's wonderful. I hope that history isn't repeating itself, and I hope that we actually make headway this time around. But I think that with Congress, you know, representing the people and really fighting the good fight on that side of things, they're up against some big players that don't want information coming out, and they're pushing, which is wonderful. We have some good people on our side that are really trying to get towards that big disclosure. And I think that we're seeing little by little things are coming out with the whistleblower protections that were put in the last NDAA, and with Grush and others being able to come forward and share their knowledge of what's been going on behind closed doors. It's only going to get better. I've heard that other whistleblowers are coming forward in the coming days. And so that'll be very interesting to hear what they have to say. But I'm glad that Grush was able to clear it and come forward and share what he knew. I think it's really opened the door for others to follow suit. And I think that we'll be making some headway here in 2024.
Yeah. I had read that there were several whistleblowers, but only three of them went to that congressional. The others, they're afraid. They're afraid to do so. But perhaps they're loosening up now and be very happy to do so. And this country, this world would be very happy to have them do so. And what would you consider disclosure? If not,
you gotta go there. I'm one of these that believes that disclosure is a process. We're in the midst of it. You know, and no one's ever going to be fully happy until everything is released. But I don't know if we'll ever see that. I do understand that there are national security, you know, considerations that we have to keep in mind. But there's other sides of things that we should be able to talk about and that the public should be aware of. It's going to be a process. We're in the middle of it right now. And as more whistleblowers come forward, it will get little more and little more information and a little more truth with each one.
Right. So, Mindy, where can our listeners go to find out more about your work?
Oh, they can visit my website, mindytautfest.com. That's mindytautfest.com. And I have more information about my book on there, where to purchase it through Amazon. I believe it's in Barnes & Noble, pretty much any bookstore. And then I also have information about Hayden Hughes and the International UFO Bureau, which I now have all of his files, and I've been pouring through some of the wonderful historic stuff that he has. The original Jimmy Carter report was filed with the International UFO Bureau. Mm-hmm. And like I said, he was in Hartshorne. He was at Aurora, Texas, with the 70s investigation of the 1897 crash. Right. And he was also there with Heaven's Gate. He had an incredible amount of research that he did with Brad Steiger with the cult as they came in to visit them several times. So it covers the whole gamut of stuff.
Well, okay. I hope our listeners do check that book out. Like I say, I read it all. I couldn't put it down. So Mindy Todd-Best, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and I hope we can get together again sometime and find out some more stuff.
Okay? Absolutely. Thank you so much, Dave.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage, scroll down to We Are Not Alone, and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archive shows. Or click on the Talk Shows button, then the We Are Not Alone button for the latest show archives. And please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. And until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you, to keep an eye on the sky.